welcome to the Brown Bowl podcast. This is a podcast created for the love of food and meant to support you on a journey to making more vegan choices, no matter where you are along the way. I'm your host, Kim Sujovalski. I'm a teacher, a certified plant-based cook, and for years, I've been helping people go vegan or take more steps in that direction by teaching you how to cook delicious vegan meals, get back in the kitchen, and improve your relationship with food. So are you ready? Lace up those trainers if you're going for a walk, or grab a cup of coffee, get comfy on the couch, and listen in. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Brown Bowl podcast. I'm so glad you're here. You know, we're almost, well, we're basically heading right into fall. We're definitely feeling a bit of a change in the weather, although it's still kind of summery. But, you know, we're starting to get those hints here and there that fall is approaching. Fall always makes me think of school supplies. I don't know why. Maybe all those years of going to get new school supplies before the school year started, and which I loved much more than going to school. But I don't know what it is. I always think of that movie with Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks where he talks about bouquets of sharpened pencils. And that's what I associate with the fall. I just think of the changing of the leaves, that nice, crisp, chilly weather, and pencils and school supplies. I don't know what it is about it, but yeah. So what I love about, you know, the changing of the seasons, I grew up in a country that has no seasons. It's basically a dry season and a rainy season, and that's pretty much all you get, right? And the weather is the same year round, which for some reason, everybody around me, my family, friends, they always, you know, saw as the best thing about our country. Our country has many wonderful things. If you're listening for the first time, the country I'm talking about is Venezuela. And the country has many wonderful things. And unfortunately, in the current crisis that it's going through, many horrible things at the moment as well. But, you know, when I grew up in my country, when I was growing up, it was amazing. And everybody loved the fact that the weather was kind of spring weather the whole year. And I can, you know, I can get it. There's no extreme weather, right? You're not scorching hot or it's not freezing cold. But I never agreed with them. I love the changing of seasons. I love change. I have been thinking about that recently. I remember that when I was a little girl, and perhaps this was the case for you or somebody you know, that kept moving the furniture in their room around, you know, throughout the year. You would come into my bedroom. When I was a kid, I would like literally, you know, push my bed to one side of the room and then push it back to the other side of the room. And I would change things around all the time. You would go into my room in April and it would be one way. And then you would go in June and it would be in a completely different way. And I think I have something embedded in my personality that needs change. And I know a lot of people who are like this. I have a very close friend who takes this to the extreme because she redecorates her whole house every time I go to visit her. Everything is in a different place. But I get it. I get it because I feel this air of being completely renewed and refreshed. And that's what I get with the changing of seasons. And I think it, you know, stops and starts really. When a season ends and a new one begins, those moments, like what we feel when it's our birthday or how we feel when it's the beginning of the year, of a new year, they're great kind of moments in which we can look back and see what we want to change moving forward, see what's working, what isn't working. And I just love that. And I've been thinking about it recently, and I just wanted to, I don't know, mention that at the top of the show today. But today's show is not about the seasons. It's not about fall or sharpened pencils or the wanting to, you know, experience a bit of change and move things around. It's all about cooking. And I know how much you love the stories about cooking from my family, from, you know, my childhood and when I started cooking and all of that related to food. So I'm definitely going to be sharing lots of cooking stories today. But what we're basically going to be talking about are those little cooking hacks. You know, we've had these episodes called the food pairings episodes. Well, they're not called the food pairings episodes. That's what I call them now. But one of them, I think, is called Delicious Plant-Based Food Pairings to Improve Your Cooking Skills. The other one is, I don't know. There's two episodes with the words food pairings in the title, part one and part two. And I share some of those perfect ingredients that really go well together. Those kinds of things really help us improve our cooking. And of course, we're focusing on vegan cooking. And there's another side to that. And it's the little hacks and the tricks and the things that you need to kind of start learning when you want to improve your cooking skills. Because you can apply them no matter whose recipe you're making, no matter what you're making in the kitchen, there are little tricks associated with certain ingredients and with certain preparations and with certain dishes that you make that you can learn and just achieve better results because you know the little magic tricks. And it's tricks that I've been learning from all of the different mentors and teachers and my official teachers, cooking teachers, and everything I've had through the years related to, you know, my culinary, I don't know, experience and adventure. And I thought it was a great idea to start this little kind of series. We'll have it from time to time, just like the food pairings series. And I can share some hacks. And it's a great way to really start practicing these things when you cook. It'll give you a little more independence, more knowledge. I think it's going to be pretty cool. And you're going to be surprised by some of them because some of them are so simple and they have to do with foods that you probably make all of the time. Now, before we get started, I want to remind you, in case you haven't checked it out, that since we're talking about cooking, of course, we of course have our signature online program, which you can check out at www.mybrownbowl.com, where I teach you, it's basically online vegan cooking classes, and I teach you so many of the basics, so many of the tricks that you're going to enjoy today. But, you know, in hundreds of videos, we have, I think right now, because new videos are added every week, we have over 225 videos, if I'm not mistaken. At the moment I'm recording this, if you're listening to this a year from now, there's a lot more because new videos are added every week. So that's one thing that you can check out if you want to improve your cooking skills. But another one, the one I wanted to mention today, is our brand new and free, hello, it's totally free. You can sign up at any time. It's our free breakfast and brunch classics course. I teach you how to make all of the classics that we love for breakfast, but in their vegan form. So we make blueberry scones and different types of pancakes. We make French toast. It's a delicious recipe for PB&J stuffed French toast. It's the most incredible thing on the planet. We make tofu scrambles. We make frittatas. We make our roll-ups, our PB&J roll-ups and our tahini and fruit roll-ups. We make smoothies. I mean, it's hash browns. Whatever you used to like, if you've gone fully vegan, you know, whatever you used to like in your meat eating days, we've got it. We even make breakfast sausages from scratch. You can make them at home if you can't find store-bought breakfast sausages where you live. So it's absolutely scrumptious, and you can go check it out and you can sign up. It's totally free to sign up. And you can check that out at www.brownbowl.com/breakfast and join right now and start cooking away. And you have me to ask questions to in the comments, which is great. And people are loving so much. So I hope I can see you in there. And now it's finally time to get the show started. Let's go. Okay, so in the blog at brownbowl.com and in the post that goes with this episode that we have today, by the way, the other day, a listener sent me an email asking, where are the show notes? Because you mentioned videos and links. Where are the show notes? I clicked the podcast tab in your menu at brownbowl.com and I couldn't find the show notes. And it's because the show notes are in the written version of these episodes, which is in the blog tab. So if you just use our search bar at brownbowl.com, you use our little search bar and you type in the same name of the episode you have on your phone and in your podcast app, you're going to find all of the links and all of the videos and all of the photographs that I'm talking about when you're listening to me. So if you do that and you type in the same name for this episode in the search bar, you're going to find the links. And two links that I want to mention right now are the ones that have to do with my story with cooking. I've kind of written two posts at the very, very early stages of our Bramble blog about my story with cooking, my journey into cooking. So there's lots more that I'm not going to mention today that is in those two posts, which you can head out and read. And I've told you in those posts and when I've mentioned, you know, these stories, how, you know, my story with cooking started from very, very early on. You know, I was obsessed with the kitchen and with ingredients since I was a very, very teeny tiny girl. And my mother, bless her heart, always let me get in the kitchen and make a mess. As you might recall in a recent episode, I told you the story of my everything goes into them, but mom eats them anyway. Caterpillar cookies. Do you remember the story of the caterpillar cookies? I don't remember what episode I tell the story in, but these were basically, you know, I would ask my mom to give me permission to go into the kitchen and make a mess because I would make a mess. And of course, this didn't happen every day. So occasionally she would let me head in there and I would just dump everything I could reach into a bowl. And this could mean flour and ketchup and, you know, sugar and chocolate and anything I would find. And I would make this weird mixture into caterpillar cookies because they were shaped like a caterpillar. I don't know why. It's just an arbitrary choice I made. And then they were always the caterpillar cookies. And then I would make my mom eat them. Well, I wouldn't make her. It was part of her responsibility as a parent to accept all the craziness that her, you know, her daughter would do and try it and say delicious and then spit it out into a napkin, right? That's how it goes. So, you know, those were the first, you know, adventures in the kitchen for me. But the first recipe that I truly learned how to master well were brownies. And this was very early on. I think I made my first batch of brownies when I was 6 or 7 years old. And I took the recipe from a very old, I think it was a Betty Crocker book that was about entertaining. I found it in my mom's bookshelf and I loved brownies and there was a recipe there for brownies. And I said, okay, well, recipe is just following instructions, right? And you just have to do what the book says. So maybe I could do it. And I, by the way, I think I still have that book. It's completely in pieces right now, but I still have it. And I have the brownie recipe earmarked. And I practiced making these brownies so often that I soon became the official brownie baker in my family and in my school. So there wasn't an event, a party, a holiday gathering, a beach trip, or, you know, a bake sale in my school in which I wasn't making these brownies. And this, you know, the wonderful thing about being a kid is that when you want to bake something, you don't even have to go shopping. You just have to raid the pantry, right? Somebody does all the shopping for you and you just go into the pantry, you grab your ingredients, you make something and then you leave everything like that. No, I didn't leave it. That was a strict rule. I had to help with cleanup if I made a mess in the kitchen. And that is still true. So, you know, it was great. That was my first official kind of recipe that I really focused on mastering and doing well. The second dish I mastered was this very weird cream cheese pasta somebody taught me how to make. And I loved it because it contained vegetables. I think the vegetables were tomatoes, peppers, leeks, onions, green onions. But the weird thing about them was that they were cut in such a teeny tiny way that it was like a little game, like a little samurai game for my 9-year-old self. I think I was 9 when I learned how to do this recipe because I remember what apartment we were living in, what kitchen we had, and I moved there when I was 9, so approximately at that age. But, you know, the little teeny tiny chopping, that wasn't the reason I loved it. The reason I loved it was that it contained a truckload of cream cheese. So you would kind of saute these tiny, tiny vegetables with lots of red vegetables. And when you added the cream cheese and kind of let the cream cheese melt into those vegetables, the cream cheese would turn pink because of the red vegetables that would kind of leach their juices, right? I think I've mentioned this movie so many times and you're going to kill me again, but I'm talking about the movie Steel Magnolias, just as in the movie Steel Magnolias and Julia Roberts' character. Pink was my signature color. So I love this pasta. And if you want proof that pink was my signature color, I've included Carlos's favorite photo of my childhood, in which I have this total gluttonous face, my golden blonde curls all around my face, and I am biting into a pink donut with a huge tray of pink donuts next to me and a cute little pajama, with some pajamas with, you know, like a little pink collar and like a little pink sleeve. And it's so cute. You have to go see it. But yeah, pink was my signature color. So I loved my pink pasta. That's what I called it. So that was the second dish that I learned how to master as a kid. Then came my obsession with watching cooking shows. And you've heard all about this in those two posts that I mentioned at the top of the show. Now, forget cartoons. Although, yeah, I did watch plenty of those too. But I would watch all of the cooking shows. I would watch Rachel and Emeril and Martha and Julia and Mario. And then I would pretend I was, this is the funniest thing, I would pretend I was the host of a cooking show when I cooked on top of a stool in the kitchen because I couldn't reach the countertop. So I was this teeny tiny kid who watched cooking shows all the time, and I would get on the stool and pretend that I was the host of my very own show. So, you know, that image of me explaining to my dogs, because of course they were my audience, why you had to sift the flour in a cake, it just makes me laugh so much because that's basically what I do now. Only now I have humans as an audience too, and that's you. And I'm so grateful for that. Although my dogs are still part of my audience as well. And, you know, I also remember watching my mom and my uncle Allie making their famous omelets. They were both fantastic omelet makers. And I could never quite master them as well as they could. I remember learning all of the basics of French sauce making from my uncle too, and how he made pan gravies right in the baking pan over a fire, like straight out of a chef's table episode. He had this way around the kitchen that was just so inspiring and so incredible. And speaking of sauces, I also remember the millions of times my mom tried to teach me how to make a hollandaise sauce and how I would get so mad as a teen because I just didn't get why, if I followed the directions like I had with my brownies and with all of the other recipes that I had knew by then, and I followed the amounts, how it would just sometimes break apart on me. And by sometimes, of course, I mean 50% of the time, because that's the way it goes with hollandaise. And it would just drive me crazy. And I can also tell you about one of my favorite food memories. And I think it's the one that sealed my fate as a cook forever. And it also happened to me to be my very first celebrity sighting ever. And I think that kind of just sticks with you. I have this memory so clear in my mind, even though it was so many years ago, but I have it so clear in my mind because it just was such a huge thing at that moment. And, you know, when I was 14, my grandmother took me to my first trip to Paris, one of my favorite cities in the world. It's, if you haven't been to Paris, you have to go right now. That has to be your next trip. It is just a place like no other. It's the way I feel about New York City. There's just an energy to Paris that no other city has. And I haven't told you about my grandmother yet a lot in this podcast or in the blog. But if you've ever watched The Gilmore Girls, that TV show that was very popular many years ago, Mrs. Emily Gilmore had my grandmother down to a T. You know, she was basically, they were basically the same person. My grandmother was very posh. She was always spotless, she was very, she could be very critical and very mean sometimes. She had perfect manners. She always had perfectly pressed clothes, incredible tastes in restaurants. And in Paris, with her then only granddaughter by her side, because then I had a cousin. So back then I was the only granddaughter. You know, when we were walking the streets of Paris and on this incredible trip, only the best Parisian food would do, according to my grandmother. So we dined at the most incredible restaurants. And on one of our last nights there, she decided it was time to take me to the Crillon Hotel. This is one of the most famous and high-end hotels in Paris. It's where the Crillon Ball takes place and all sorts of fancy stuff that I didn't understand back then, but to her it was, you know, very important. Didn't get why I didn't get it and why I didn't know about this stuff. You know, keep in mind that my usual lifestyle and home back home was hippie land all the way, you know, dream catchers on the wall and flowy clothes all the way, all the way. In fact, I was on that trip to Paris with my grandmother only because my mom was trekking across India meditating with the monks, like in the Himalayas with the monks. So yeah, talk about contrast, right? And, you know, we walked into the restaurant of the hotel to have our lunch. And as soon as our meal arrives, I see my grandmother's eyes widen as she tells me that somebody is sitting behind me. And who was sitting behind me? It was Julia Child. Yes, the Julia Child. If you love cooking, if you watched old cooking shows, if you've watched the movie Julie and Julia or read the book, you know who Julia Child is. And she was sitting behind me. And remember how I told you about my cooking show obsession? Well, I knew who she was. And now I could have literally leaned over and stolen her buttered roll. That's how close we were. And her voice was just as it was in her videos. She had this very high and, well, kind of deep and very strange voice. You have to go check out, Google Julia Child in, find her videos in YouTube. I'm sure there are some there still. And yeah, it was just as in her videos. And yes, she was that tall. She's this big, incredible force of a woman. She felt like a force to be reckoned with. And when I came back home from that trip, I became even more obsessed with her and with cooking. And I think it's no coincidence that I started seriously cooking and taking classes when I was 15 and 16, soon after coming back from that trip, partly because of all the incredible food that I had had in Paris and the experience of looking at the markets and the ingredients and all of that. Now, of course, sadly, this was before my vegan days, but still, you know, it inspired and taught me so much, so many of the things that I know today. And in fact, Julia Child's book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, in spite of it including instructions on how to debone animals, it's responsible for so many of the things that you have learned from me at Brown Bowl, because she really was one of my teachers, even though we've never met. And, you know, suffice it to say, with all these stories and so many others that are scattered around this podcast, I have had many, many culinary teachers and mentors from all different walks of life. And, you know, from the hosts of all those cooking shows that I would watch for hours on end, to my mother and my uncle, to my official cooking instructors and cooking teachers, to cookbook authors and friends who I've seen cook. You know, I've followed many of these closely, and that always brings about two things, right? First, and I think I've talked about this before, first you realize that every cook has his or her own style, right? Even if you were to line them up and ask each of them to make you a grilled cheese sandwich, some would use panini presses, others would melt butter in a frying pan, others who love to get very fancy pants would add, I don't know, caramelized onions or cranberries or something like that. Some would make their own cheese before putting it in the sandwich. So each person, each cook is so unique in their techniques and their go-to ingredients and their style and the way they layer flavors. There's really a pattern. That's why I love watching a cook for a long time, watching lots of recipes and videos. And then I try to see what somebody else is doing. And it's very important because you really start seeing the trends and the different ways and techniques that people have. They're also who I've learned countless kitchen tricks and hacks from. And today, just like we did in those food pairing episodes, I'm going to teach you some of my favorites, and we're just kind of getting the ball rolling for future episodes in which we're going to go through even more. You know, these little cooking hacks, they're great because no matter what you're making or whose recipe you're diving into, these are going to really stick to mind, and they're going to help you get a great result every time because it's just a little rule. No amounts, no specifics, just a kind of a guideline that you can apply every time you have that food in front of you. And they're kind of little culinary secrets and tricks and steps that can help you get delicious ingredients to, you know, shine even more. And I think it's going to be fun. And these are really simple, and we're going to do more in a future episode. But let's get started with the ones that I have for you today. So the first one is what I like to call the batter it up hack. So whenever you're making something fried with some kind of batter or breading, so think, for example, country fried seitan. I have this picture that was so popular in our Instagram. I haven't filmed this recipe for you, but I will at some point. It's a recipe for basically country fried seitan. So instead of having fried chicken, you would have fried seitan. And it's just unbelievable. The photo is unbelievable. It looks like something that came out of a KFC bucket, but it didn't. It's got no animal products in it. So if you're doing, for example, that or a seitan scallopini or something like that where there's breading, add a bit of baking powder to the flour mix. So you're basically dunking whatever protein you have into some kind of vegan buttermilk or, you know, some kind of marinade to help the breading stick to it. But in that part that is the breading, which could be, you know, breadcrumbs and flour and spices or whatever you're adding to it, or just plain flour, add a bit of baking powder because it's going to help it get much, much crisper. So that's the batter it up hack. We're going to talk about butter today too. Okay, the next one is what I call the crispy and fried hack. So again, with something that you're frying that has a crispy exterior, I know that there's a huge love of placing things that have been fried on paper towels, right? I know that this runs deep, but even better, much better, for the perfect crispy texture is to let fried foods rest, but on a rack. So that means they have air circulating around them. You let any excess oil drip down, and sure, then you can pat it with paper towels too on top if you see that there's parts that still have a bit of oil. But you know, having air circulating all around the food when it's on a rack, it means that foods aren't going to steam and they're going to remain crisper. So think of perfectly crispy vegetable tempura or the examples I gave you before. So yeah, air circulation instead of putting something on a plate in which, you know, even if you have the slightest sloped sides in that plate, the heat can kind of create a little bit of steam and it's going to make things soggy. So rack when you're frying something and you want it to have a crispy coating. Okay, the next hack is my wasabi avocado hack. So, you know, we've heard about lemon juice and lime juice and how it can go a long way into helping avocado not turn brown too quickly. That is absolutely true. The main thing that will help avocado not turn brown is not having it be exposed to the air. So if you add a little bit of lemon or lime juice to the top and then you put, you know, plastic wrap, but very closely next to the skin, well, not the skin, the meat of the avocado, That's going to help so much. But something you might not know, and that's a little hack I have for you today, is that if you add a bit of wasabi for kind of an Asian style guacamole, because yes, you are going to taste the wasabi, it's strong. But if you love it, it's going to stay as green as the Grinch for so much longer. This is something that I discovered by accident when I was developing our Asian seitan fajitas with wasabi avocado cream, which you have in our recipe section at bramble.com. I was doing this and I had some of that avocado cream left over, which basically all it had was salt, lime juice, and wasabi. And the wasabi just made it last for twice as long as it would have normally, only with the lime juice. It was incredible. So a little bit of wasabi helps to prevent it from turning brown. But of course, you have to like wasabi because you're going to feel it in the flavor. All right, another hack that I love is called the carrot in my sauce hack. So a yummy addition to any bolognese sauce is to add some finely chopped carrots at the beginning of the process. So if you're sauteing a little bit of onion and garlic for the sauce, add some finely chopped carrots. It will add great sweetness and it will help with the texture too. So many of the commercial brands of sauces have so much sugar added. Have you checked the ingredients of your pasta sauce? Sometimes it's just sugar is the second ingredient or something like that. It's crazy. And sure, sweetness is part of a good tomato sauce, especially a bolognese. And here I'm talking, of course, about a vegan bolognese. But carrot provides that naturally, which is pretty cool. And, you know, a little goes a long way. So all you need is a little bit. And for the meat component, when trying to veganize this classic, right, bolognese, I love some options for making a meaty pasta sauce is using vegan meat crumbles or crumbled tofu or tempeh or textured soy protein, which I love because you can always have it in the pantry and just add it to the sauce and it rehydrates itself right in the sauce. But you can also use chopped mushrooms or even cauliflower, chopped cauliflower as the meaty texture in the sauce. There are so many options, you guys, but always add a little bit of that carrot for sweetness. It's going to give you a classic, classic feel of that, you know, Italian sauce. All right, chocolate. We're going to talk about chocolate a lot today. But the first one is the hack that I've called a little salt with my chocolate. Now this, I'm cheating because I've mentioned this in our food pairings episode, but it's so important that you keep it in mind that I thought it was also good to mention it in today's episode. So add sea salt whenever you're making anything with chocolate, even hot chocolate. You know, as we talked in those food pairings episodes, salt helps the cocoa flavor really come through. And if you're making brownies, my signature brownies, add some coarse sea salt or these little kind of flakes of sea salt. People are going to find them a little bit if they bite into the brownie. They're occasionally going to get one. And it's just wild. The sensation and the flavor of the two of them together, it's pretty incredible. And now they are selling chocolate bars with sea salt. Have you seen this? So that's, yeah, it's pretty cool. It's trendy because it's a classic. It's actually a very well-known secret in the culinary world. Okay, so pancakes. We've been talking about pancakes a lot recently because we made a delicious blueberry pancake recipe for vegan outreach last month. And we released our free breakfast and brunch classics course that I told you about at the beginning of the episode. So we've been making so many pancakes, you guys. And you have our signature pancakes if you're a member of our online program too. So this is the pancake secret hack. There's a secret to good pancakes. And the secret, well, there are several secrets, but one of the main secrets is you need to let pancake batters rest for 10 to 15 minutes before you cook your pancakes. So once your batter is ready, let it rest for 10 to 15 minutes. It makes all the difference, especially if they're buttermilk pancakes and you really let that buttermilk develop with the acid that's in the buttermilk. Now you can practice this by making our yummy blueberry pancakes that we made for vegan outreach. And the recipe is in the recipe section at bramble.com. So you can check that out. And yeah, so pretty cool. You'll get fluffy pancakes, tall pancakes. It's amazing. Okay, next hack is the make me a cupcake hack. And it has to do with cupcakes, but it also has to do with cakes and with bread. So when it comes to baking with flour, with wheat flour, right? Standard flour. There's one little hack that can really help or hinder the final product. And that is how much you develop the gluten in the batter. You know, we develop gluten when flour, gluten, by the way, is the protein found in wheat. So it's the protein part of flour. That's when people ask me, where do I get my protein? I tell them, you even get protein when you eat bread, because there is, it's the protein we all know as gluten. So we develop this gluten when, well, I mean, flour always has gluten, but when we talk about developing gluten, we talk about, these are like little tiny coils that we stretch or that are, you know, kind of not, this is hard to explain in audio, but when we're developing those, we're developing the gluten in a recipe, we are kind of making it stretchy. Okay, that's basically what we're doing. So it happens when flour comes in contact with a liquid and we add movement to the batter. How do we do this? We do this by kneading it or mixing it, depending on what we're making. So for fluffy and moist cakes and cupcakes, you have to make sure to never overmix your batters. You can go wild if it's just the dry ingredients or the wet ingredients separately. You can go wild with that. But once you put these two together, you're starting to kind of, let's use the word activate. It's not really what happens like with yeast, but let's use the word activate. I think it might help kind of illustrate it. We're kind of getting that gluten amped up. And when we add movement, we get it amped up even more. So if we overmix, we're going to get a different result in cupcakes and cakes. Because when we overmix a batter, we are going to get those little coils to get very stretchy and tight. And that's going to give us a very kind of chewy texture. We don't want a chewy texture when we're making cakes and cupcakes. We want a fluffy texture. So mix your cake and cupcake batters with a fork or on low if you're using a mixer. And if you're using the fork, make the shape of a number 8 and resist the temptation to get rid of all of the lumps. Some lumps are going to be totally fine. Just try to make sure to mix softly until there is no more loose flour, but don't go overboard. You know what's, if you do, if you overmix, you're going to develop the gluten and you'll get that chewy texture. And when making breads, on the other hand, the opposite is true, right? Here we do want to stretch those little coils out. We want them to get very kind of stretchy and chewy. So we knead and knead and knead the dough until the dough is stretchy and the gluten is well developed so that the bread comes out with that chewy texture that we all know and love in bread. So that's a little bit of the science behind gluten and flour. And depending on what you're making, you can decide how much to mix or knead or how to combine the ingredients so that you get a good result. Pretty cool. Pretty cool, right? Okay, next up, the butter in the freezer hack. So one thing that makes traditional butter, like dairy-based butter, and non-dairy butter very different is the fact that when chilled, when we have these chilled, dairy-based butter hardens much more and it retains the cold temperature for longer than non-dairy butter. So normally this isn't an important issue, right? We don't really care. In fact, sometimes I love the fact that I can spread non-dairy butter right out of the fridge and it can actually spread it. That doesn't happen with dairy butter. You have this big lump of stiff butter if you keep it in the refrigerator. So which you have to do if you're eating dairy-based butter and non-dairy butter as well. So, normally the temperature is not that important except for what I just mentioned, wanting to spread it on the bread with no difficulty. But when you want to create flaky pockets in certain doughs, for example, pies, puff pastry, quiches, scones, cutting up the non-dairy butter into cubes and placing them on a plate, like on a shallow plate, and placing that plate with the butter in the freezer for about 30 minutes, it can really help. This is going to ensure that the pieces of non-dairy butter get really, really cold, like you would have with dairy-based butter. And they will then create pockets of air within the dough when that cold butter in it hits the heat of the oven. So that's what creates those flaky pockets and that flakiness in puff pastry and scones and pies. So sometimes because non-dairy butter is softer, it's harder to achieve this texture, but by freezing it in little cubes, it really helps. You get an incredible, incredible result. And you're going to get drool-worthy results from that. And you can make, by the way, to practice, you can make our blueberry scones in our new free breakfast and brunch course, which you can check out by visiting www.brownbowl.com/breakfast. Okay, cream cheese frosting queen hack. You ready? Who else loves cream cheese frosting? I do. It's my favorite kind of frosting. Anyway, there's nothing worse than biting into the perfect moist cupcake, but that has a frosting in which you can actually feel the powdered sugar. Have you been in the situation? You feel a grainy frosting? Good frosting cannot be like this. Good frosting should be silky and smooth and creamy and rich. And there's a trick to getting that perfect texture. So the first thing you can do is make sure to sift powdered sugar before adding it to your mixer. That's the first thing. But especially the number one hack when it comes to frosting is that you need to mix the powdered sugar and the non-dairy butter extremely well. Extremely well. Do it extremely well. When you think it's done, do it a little bit longer. And only then should you add your cream cheese for the perfect frosting that doesn't get grainy on you. So yeah, pass the red velvet, please. That's my favorite cupcake. What's your favorite cupcake? Mix well. When you think it's done, do it for longer. And then you add your cream cheese. And don't forget to sift your powdered sugar. Those are some little frosting making hacks. Okay, yeast queen hack. So we're going to talk about baker's yeast. So the type of yeast, not nutritional yeast, not, you know, baking powder or other, you know, kind of chemical leaveners. We're talking about actual yeast, baker's yeast that we use to make bread or pizza dough, for example, right? So when you're trying to develop baker's yeast, what usually happens when we're making bread or pizza is we develop the yeast first in a little bit of water. And then we add that to our flour and all the other ingredients. But we let that kind of bubble up and form this foam and kind of get very activated. So when you're doing this, always make sure that the water that you use is lukewarm. It cannot be too hot and it cannot be too cold or you will kill the yeast and your dough is not going to rise. So this is one thing you have to do. Make sure it's lukewarm. So think of a temperature in which you would get into a bath, right? And also add a bit of sugar to the yeast in the water. Yeast loves sugar and it's going to help it develop and grow before you add it to the rest of your recipe. Pretty cool. By the way, I've always mentioned this and people cringe, but when I tell you that after developing yeast with the water and the sugar and all of that, you do not see bubbles. You do not see activity in the surface. You don't see foam or something. It can vary. It doesn't have to be all of these, but some kind of thing that's going on, dump it out and start again. Very important. You really need to see some activity there. All right. Shiny chocolate sauce hack. Chocolate again. Chocolate is so cool. It's this very magical thing that has so many tricks and applications to it. It's incredible. Chocolatiers really, they have to study for years to learn and master chocolate. So one thing I'm going to teach you how to do today is get a very shiny chocolate sauce that stays creamy and melty. So whenever you're making that kind of a chocolate sauce, right, something you want to stay creamy as opposed to harden later, whether it's for dipping fruit or covering a cake or drizzling over cupcakes or over ice cream or anything like that, anything delicious that you want to make even more delicious. Melt the chocolate pieces in a double boiler. So what you do is you bring a small pot with a little bit of water to a boil, just to, you know, just put some water in the bottom of the pan. And you add a heat-resistant bowl on top. Then you add the chocolate in the bowl and you let it melt in the bowl over the water that is bubbling underneath. But the chocolate never comes in contact with that water. Once it's melted, once you see that the chocolate has melted, add some non-dairy butter and stir and stir and stir. The more you stir, the shinier the chocolate gets. And that's going to give you this perfect glossy look for your cakes and your cupcakes and things like that. It's beautiful. The more you stir after you add that non-dairy butter, the shinier it gets. And this chocolate sauce stays soft is what we call chocolate ganache. If you've ever heard of chocolate ganache, that means it's a chocolate sauce, a creamy chocolate that stays creamy. This is different from tempered chocolate, which then hardens when it's cooled. So think of chocolate fondue texture as in ganache, chocolate ganache, versus chocolate covered strawberries, which then harden, which is tempered chocolate. So that's a little bit of chocolate info if you didn't know. All right, next up is my hack called Bloom the Roux. A roux is something we create in a pan with some fat and some flour to thicken up sauces and stews and things like that. You've watched me do this in many of our videos. So when you're making stews or soups and you want to make a roux for thickening and you want to add some flavorful spices to the mix, a great trick that you can do is you can heat some oil or non-dairy butter, any kind of fat in a pan, and you add your spices and you let them bloom. This is a fancy term for letting them get intense and smelling nicely. That's all it means. It means you're heating up the spices and the fragrances are going to get released. And then you add some flour. You stir very frequently, make sure it doesn't burn, and you add all of that to the stew. This is going to help it thicken and get flavorful if you didn't start your stew with a roux to begin with. So this is a great way to thicken up something that you thought was going to get thick and didn't. It's a great way, and it's a great way to add some extra spices. That's not just putting the spices into the pot. You bloom them and you get so many more flavors out of them. And last but not least, last hack. You gotta leave room for pie. This is the you gotta leave room for pie hack. And you know me and my love affair with pie. You know, I've told you many times that my secret dream is to open the Serves Nothing But Pie diner from the movie Waitress. Have you seen this movie? It's my favorite food movie. And, you know, that's how deep my love of pie goes. This movie is about a girl who makes pies in this diner that only serves pies. And they make savory pies and sweet pies and chocolate pies and, you know, all kinds of pie. It was basically somebody went into my dreams and made that movie from what they saw in there. And, you know, a little secret trick for when you're baking the pie shell first. So here's the deal with pies. Sometimes the whole pie goes in the oven. This is the case for apple pie. You make your pie dough, you put it on the pie plate, you add your fillings, you top it with the second part of the dough, and you pop everything into the oven. But other pies and quiches and tarts require that you bake the pie shell first and then you add the filling. And what happens sometimes when you have to do this is that your pie shell can shrink in the oven. So when has this ever happened to you? You take it out of the oven and the pie shell is actually a little bit smaller than when you put it in there. And it's very annoying, right? You want it to fill up that pie plate. So a great way to prevent this is you place your pie dough on the pie plate like you normally do. You cover it with plastic wrap, like not over the whole thing, but you know, like you press the plastic wrap against all of the pie dough across the plate just to cover it well, not let any air form any tough skin on the dough or anything like that. And you stick that in the freezer for 20 minutes. And then you take it out of the freezer and you bake it with some pie weights. So you put some parchment paper on top and your pie weights. This can be legumes or, you know, pie weights if you have pie weights. And you bake it. And this is going to prevent a lot of the shrinkage. It might not prevent all of it, but it certainly is going to prevent a lot of the shrinkage. It's just something that often happens with heat and these types of pies, especially when you're making smaller pies. So this is a great trick. If you've experienced pie shrinkage, this is a great way to prevent that. So yeah, that was so much fun, you guys. We will have more yummy kitchen and cooking hacks coming soon. But as usual, in the meantime, I want to know if you have any cooking hacks that you use in your kitchen, things your grandmother taught you, your mother taught you, your father taught you, your grandfather taught you, you learned in a cooking show or in a cooking class. If you have any of those, make sure to leave them in the comment section at bramble.com in the post that goes with this episode. And of course, check out our free course that I mentioned. Check out our online program if you want to take your culinary journey to another level and you want to learn some new techniques. You know, cooking and great cooking is at everyone's reach. All it requires is practice and learning the tricks. Once you learn the tricks, that's it. You're probably going to become my teacher at some point. So that's all I have for you today, guys. Please remember to leave us a glowing review if you feel like it. It really helps us reach more people. It's the way to support this podcast if you love it. Everything in this podcast is free and is always going to be free. So this is a great way to help us if you have felt that we've helped you in any way with any of the many topics we discuss in this podcast. And it's very easy to do. You just have to grab your phone, open the podcast app, type in Bramble in the little search icon, and you go to our podcast, click write a review, or click the reviews tab, then click write a review, and you leave it there. And you can also do this through the iTunes app on your computer. If you open your iTunes, you know, your regular iTunes where you listen to your music in the computer, you type in Bramble in the search bar and go to our podcast, and you can leave us a review in the reviews section. And we will be so, so, so grateful. I am so grateful that you are here listening to these stories today. And I hope this inspires you to head into your kitchen and do some experimenting. And as usual, I will see you next week on our little date, which is on Thursday, like every other week. Thanks so much, guys. See you then.